History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to our series on history's most insane rulers. In the last episode, we looked at the life of Ibrahim I, who basically grew up in a prison in the imperial harem of the Ottoman Empire, and at the end of his life, an enemy faction executed him. Now we're going to look at someone who maybe has the most uplifting story of all the people in this series, and that's British King George III. Now he's infamous for going mad, but that doesn't come till much later on in his life, and that doesn't completely define the rest of his life either. He also isn't remembered as poorly as people like Caligula or Ibrahim or Charles the Mad. But let's not get too far ahead of ourselves. Let's go back to the beginning of his story and see how it unfolds. While British people have mixed feelings about King George, Americans, if they know how he went mad at the end of his life, might be tempted to feel a bit of Schadenfreude. This is a German origin term that means pleasure from another person's misery, which is fitting for how to describe someone feels about George III since he's also German origin. The reason they might feel that is because George III was the villain of the American Revolution, and he spent the final years of his life insane. He experienced 5 extended bouts of madness in his life, with the final one lasting until his death in 1820. These episodes consisted of anxiety, hallucinations, insomnia, and manic and depressive episodes. During this time, George suffered from poor medical care designed to cure his madness, but it only worsened it. Medicine was in a primitive state at this time, and his physicians didn't know that treatments such as blistering, binding him in a straitjacket, chaining him to a chair, or prescribing him high doses of arsenic would damage his mental state. But by most accounts of his life, the Schadenfreude is undeserved. George was described by those who knew him as an unfailing gentleman. Only in revisionist American popular accounts, which were written in the patriotic Reconstruction period of the 1860s and 1870s, does the image of George as a villainous tyrant survive. This image was created by those who barely knew him outside of descriptions from the Declaration of Independence, who describe him as a tyrant who sought to suffocate the noble American experiment in the cradle. This is how the Declaration of Independence describes George. He has refused to assent to the laws necessary to the public good. He has abdicated government here. He has dissolved legislative houses repeatedly. He has plundered our seas, ravaged our coasts, burnt our towns, and destroyed the lives of our people. Historians are less abusive towards George, but they still question his effectiveness as a king, and many in Britain remember him as a mad monarch or fool. But despite all this, he was beloved by his subjects and mourned at his death. Well, George's reign encompassed far more than just the Revolutionary War in the United States. He ruled in some of the most difficult decades of the emerging British Empire. Domestic and foreign challenges threatened its destruction. Across the channel in Europe, the French monarchy fell, Napoleon Bonaparte rose through the ranks during the French Revolution and conquered France afterwards, and ruled it as emperor. Then Napoleon had his eye on conquering Great Britain, which became engulfed in the Napoleonic Wars from 1803 to 1814. France embargoed the island and instituted a naval blockade. If there ever was a time when Great Britain needed a king to shore up its resolve and strengthen it, George's long reign was that time. And he did so despite his deteriorating mental health. George William Frederick was born on June 4, 1738, to Frederick Lewis, Prince of Wales, and Princess Augusta of Saxe-Gotha, who'd arrived in England 2 years earlier, speaking no English. His education was fitting for a British royal. He learned foreign languages, theology, and the sciences. The young prince was the first British monarch to receive a systematic scientific education. Early in his childhood, he learned a wide range of physical sciences, including chemistry, astronomy, geography, and branches of the humanities. He knew English, German, French, and Latin. He also studied theology and the arts. George's father adored Baroque music and instilled the same appreciation in his children. But many considered him lacking the aptitude to lead Great Britain well. Tutors described George as a willing student, but lethargic and incapable of concentration, completely incapable of any abstract speculation. He had an agreeable disposition, but acted whiny and churlish when angry. Some accounts claim he had the writing level of a child, even as a young adult. Whether due to an ineffective education or poor aptitude, George didn't engage in intellectual pursuits. His view of royal government was to uphold the House of Hanover, so he preferred to involve himself in administrative affairs, no matter how inconsequential. Here he did show interest and enthusiasm. One long-repeated story goes that George couldn't read until he was 10 years old. Cambridge University's renowned historian of the 18th century, J.H. Plum, characterized the king as an unbalanced man of low intelligence. He was very stupid. Had he been born in different circumstances, it is unlikely he could have earned a living except as an unskilled manual laborer, he wrote. John Brooke, an archivist for the Royal Commission on Historical Manuscripts, responded to this unflattering characterization with a 1972 biography of George that detailed his love of literature, art, and patronage of the King's Library at the Royal Academy. He also patronized the natural philosopher Sir William Herschel, the discoverer of Uranus. And there's reason to think that even as a child, George wasn't an imbecile. Stories of him being a late reader are unsubstantiated. He was a student of average ability, who suffered more from social isolation and emotional immaturity than stupidity. Regarding George's later bouts of madness, Brooke believes his disorder wasn't due to feeble-mindedness or any mental illness of the sort. It was indicative of a delirium induced by attacks of a blood disease. His illness may have produced symptoms that could have been easily misdiagnosed as schizophrenia, psychoneurosis, or hysteria. But it's a little bit too simple to say that the king was doomed to insanity because his mind was weak. George's reign began far earlier than he expected, but he managed his first years as king competently by remaining close to his moral beliefs, and many said he remained way too close. His father, who was heir to the throne, died just as the young prince entered adolescence, making George III next in line to be king. Following the death of his grandfather, George II, George III was crowned in 1760 at 22 years old. A year later, he married German princess Charlotte of Mecklenburg-Strelitz. The two had a happy marriage, and the queen bore him 15 children, 9 sons and 6 daughters. They shared a love of music, but otherwise had few interests. The couple went to sleep each night at 10 o'clock, and as rumors go, they maintained the most boring court in all of Europe. Boredom came, what his critics would say, from his piety. The king was a thoroughly devout Anglican. He infused his politics and family life with religion, and pressured family members to uphold the same principles. He looked scornfully on the deviance of his brothers and pushed for the Royal Marriages Act of 1772, which required crown approval for anyone marrying into the royal family. His children also couldn't marry until the age of 25, which they thought would prevent rash decisions. George III as a father ran a loving but obedient household. He demanded strict discipline and meted out severe punishment to his children. Princesses had to stand while talking to him and exit the room walking backwards, as if they were foreign envoys. Queen Charlotte domineered the girls, secluding and isolating them from the world and eligible marriage partners. The princes responded to such strictness by seeking secret marriages or carrying on long affairs. The future George IV wed the Catholic widow, Maria Smith, in an illegal ceremony. His father annulled the marriage on discovering their union. Another prince, Augustus, married non-royals twice, while Prince William fathered 10 illegitimate children with his mistress. The princesses, however, had no chance of escape, and they were trapped in the boredom of the court due to their parents rejecting all marriage offers. 30-year-old Princess Charlotte only managed to marry King Frederick of Württemberg in 1797. Princess Elizabeth was 38 when she wrote in 1808, "We go on vegetating as we have done for the last 20 years of our lives." But unlike other historical figures known for mental instability, George III was mentally healthy throughout his youth. He didn't suffer debilitation from madness until well into his 50s. George was beloved by his people, was a popular monarch during a time of tremendous international challenges, and he was seen as a sturdy, reliable figure. He was an active king during the American Revolution and a more active monarch during the Napoleonic Wars. George also enjoyed the favor of his subjects and was known for his generous support of the Royal Academy and charitable contributions, which came from his personal income. The king had unimpeachable piety. As a testimony to his devoutness, he's one of the few British kings who is known to have never taken a mistress, which really says a lot for a monarch at this time in history. All right, well, that's his background. Let's get into his first bout of madness. George's first health crisis happened in 1765. At the time, the nature of this illness was unknown. The symptoms were like later attacks. First, an eruption on his face appeared, then a cough and a fever, then he had a mental disturbance. He suffered pain in the abdomen, legs, and back. The king also experienced anxiety and insomnia. The illness occurred during the passage of the Stamp Act. 19th century American historian George Bancroft, who also served as U.S. Secretary of the Navy and was patriotic to the core, interpreted these symptoms as proof that George III was already irreparably stricken with madness. How well he was is unknown, but he recovered completely after a few weeks. The King's 1765 episode was a state secret and quickly forgotten once he recovered. George enjoyed uninterrupted good health until the summer of 1788. He could walk 12 miles on his way from Windsor to London, more than the Prince of Wales could do. But this calm period didn't last. He relapsed in June 1788, of which detailed and independent medical records testify. He had recurrent instances of severe abdominal pain and obstructive jaundice, which Sir George Baker, the king's physician, diagnosed as biliary concretions in the gall duct. The king acted excitable in July and August. Then, colic reoccurred in October, followed by aches and pains, muscular weakness, and stiffness. He was diagnosed with rheumatism and gout, which severely affected his legs. George's condition then worsened with constipation, racing pulse, sweating attacks, cramp, lameness, and hoarseness. By October 1788, the king started showing signs of mental trouble, albeit in harmless episodes. His physicians tried cures, but medicine was very primitive at that time, and knowledge of mental illnesses was almost non-existent. Mental disorders fell under the umbrella category of madness, and they were treated with therapies that were often ineffective at best and destructive at worst. Treatments including placing poultices of Spanish fly over George's body in order to produce painful blisters and draw out the evil humors, an application of the Greek notion of the body being made up of black and yellow bile, phlegm, and blood that needed to be kept in proper proportion for someone to be healthy. The king's physician was then Dr. Francis Willis, a clergyman of the Church of England, who received medical training in Oxford. With this dual training in the needs of the body and the spirit, Willis prescribed for the physical and the spiritual wants of his patients, particularly for mental diseases. Earlier in his career, he created an establishment that was specifically for the treatment of the mentally ill. For almost 60 years, he never had less than 30 patients under his care, and he treated over 800 mental patients at the asylum at Greatford in Lincolnshire in his long career. Fellow physicians all agreed that he could aid George in his present incapacity. Willis joined the Corps of Physicians at the palace on December 6, 1788. Willis and others believed George's madness was the result of over-anxiety in public affairs and overly strenuous exercise, which had caused what they called a fever on the brain. As George hadn't suffered from such an attack before, and as 9 out of 10 patients so afflicted eventually recovered, the group of physicians had hopes for the king's full restoration. They believed in a cure for his illness in as little as 6 to 8 weeks. 2 years was the longest known duration of any such similar illness among them. On October 16th, after having walked 4 hours in the rain, George remained at St. James Place without changing his clothes. Stomach spasms then struck him the next day. He remained still for days, which the whole household found terrifying. The king then came into the equerries room. There, he found Generals Bude and Goldsworth. He opened his waistcoat and displayed 2 sizable spots on his chest. The two recommended the king to take care not to catch a cold or the spots could rupture. George rejected this advice with ill humor. He rode outside and came home very wet. The spots disappeared, but a slight fever followed. Then derangement struck. The main feature of George's illness was that he talked endlessly. Speech came thick and fast, sometimes for hours at a time. He made strange statements, and 2 stood out in particular. First, that Acts of Parliament could dissolve marriages. Second, his Hanoverian background, his Hanoverian dominion, had been restored, and he was shortly to go there, to Germany. The reason this was strange is because George may have come from a line of German royals, but he was born in Great Britain and never visited Hanover. But no matter how strangely the king babbled, he retained his prudishness, and he never used any profanity, even in the depths of his madness. The highest praise, Colonel Digby writes, who remained at the king's vigil for hours in his room, that could be found of his character would not equal what in those moments showed itself, that with his heart and mind entirely open, not one wrong idea appeared. All was benevolence, charity, rectitude, love of country, and anxiety of its welfare. This more docile period ended when he turned violent. By the end of 1788, his symptoms were unmanageable, and his doctors couldn't find any relief. In early November, the king and his son, George IV, fell into a conflict which resulted in the king grabbing his son and trying to smash his head against the wall. An observer commented that the king was foaming at the mouth, and his eyes were so bloodshot they had the appearance of currant jelly. The look of his eyes, the tone of his voice, every gesture, and his whole deportment represent a person in a most furious passion of anger. Other accounts by physicians and attendants describe the king as growing so agitated during a meal that he lost control, grabbed his son, the Prince of Wales, and threw him against a wall. He often spoke till he was exhausted, and the moment he could recover his breath, began again while the foam ran out of his mouth. After this, the king was restrained and put in a straitjacket and strapped into an iron chair, where he spent a lot of time while undergoing violent mood swings. Toward the end of his first attack, he begged the royal staff to end his life. On November 6th, the Prince of Wales, the Duke of York, physicians, and equerries were reclining on sofas and chairs close to the king's apartment, when, to their shock, George appeared among them. He was as surprised to find himself among them as they were him. The king asked what they were doing there, as he didn't recognize the princes due to the dim lighting in the apartment. None of them had the heart to approach the sick king. Even his physician, George Baker, declined to lead George back to his bedchamber. The king suddenly recognized Baker, grabbed him, and pushed him up against a wall, telling him that his complaint was a mistake. Colonel Digby, the queen's chamberlain, stepped in. He told George that he must go to bed, took him by the arm, and tried to lead him toward his apartment. The king then cried, "I will not go. Who are you?" "I'm Colonel Digby, sir. Your Majesty has been very good to me often, and now I am going to be very good to you, for you must come to bed. It is necessary for your life." He was taken by surprise, and the king allowed himself to be taken to his bedchamber as passively as if he were a child. George's poor health and the mysterious nature of his sudden onset of madness gradually became known to the public. The British in general mourned, as the king was well-loved at this time for being a pious royal. George Villiers, a young politician who was close to Princess Amelia, the king's youngest daughter, wrote on November 11th that the stock market had fallen 2%. Other nobles were equally alarmed. "You may easily believe," wrote Lord Sidney on November 13th, "that the hurry and ferment are great at present. People in general of all ranks seem to be truly sensible of the calamitous effects to be dreaded from an unfavorable termination of His Majesty's disorder." On November 28th, a cabinet council met to discuss recommendations from the king's physicians of George's removal from Windsor to recover in the open air at Kew Palace, the king's favorite royal residence. But he hated leaving Windsor so much, the aides realized their only choice was to force him out. It wasn't until his physicians swore that the convalescence was necessary that the cabinet adopted the advice. When George finally saw his lodgings at Kew, he burst into tears. Each examination of the king's condition provoked opposing diagnoses from physicians. Others began to rally against his physician for his lenient attitude toward George. Dr. Willis was criticized on three counts. First, that he permitted the king to read Shakespeare's tragedy of King Lear, a drama in which an elderly monarch's family schemes to marginalize and depose him, ultimately ruining him. The offending play was called "The most proper in the English language be put into his hands." Second, Prime Minister Pitt had given the royal patient a razor and scissors. Third, Dr. Wills afforded George interviews with the Queen and young princesses, allowing the royals to see their sovereign in a terrible condition. By December, he was described as under an entire alienation of mind and considered mad. The king refused food, became too restless to lie down, tore off his bandages covering his blisters, and threw off bedclothes. Wills responded to the king's behavior like he would any of his hundreds of earlier mental patients and strapped him into a straitjacket, a band across his torso, and his legs, which were bound to a bedpost. On Christmas Day, George dubbed his pillow Prince Octavius, who was to be newborn this day. He believed London under floodwaters and issued orders to those who had long died. Hey everyone, Scott here. We're going to take a very short break for a word from our sponsors. During this period, political fault lines were opening up in England. Moderate Whigs and Tories supported Tory statesman William Pitt the Younger, while Charles James Fox led the more radical Whig opposition. Due to this squabbling factionalism, George's mental health became a matter of political opportunism. In the period of 1788-1789, his mental state was so unstable that the parties fought over whether the Prince of Wales, his son, should be regent, ruling in place of the monarch, who was considered too incapacitated to lead. Committees of Parliament asked the king's physicians if he could continue as head of state. In January 1789, it became unavoidable that the Prince of Wales regency be named. A bill passed the House of Commons and was sent to the House of Lords, but at this point, George unexpectedly recovered. George surprised everyone by his rapid return to health and mental clarity. At the end of February 1789, Prime Minister William Pitt claimed that George appeared to be free from all disorder, that his manner was unusually composed and dignified, and that when he spoke of his illness, it was as a thing that had passed, which had left no other impression on his mind than gratitude to heaven for his recovery, as well as to those who had stood by him in his calamity. There was no sign whatsoever of his mental illness. In March, he was declared cured, though still described as emaciated and enfeebled. George regained his royal authority. Afterwards, the king sent for his old friends. He thanked them for what he called the affectionate fidelity with which they had adhered to him when so many others had deserted him. On March 10, 1789, an announcement to Parliament told of George's complete restoration to health. He returned to London to an illuminated St. Paul's Cathedral. The public was ecstatic. At the end of June, the king left Windsor to spend the summer at the seaside town of Weymouth in Dorset, 120 miles southwest of London. During the journey, popular acclaim greeted him. He attended a church service there, and the congregation was unable to restrain itself, bursting out into "God Save the King" instead of the appointed psalm. George resumed political leadership. He suppressed the 1798 Irish Rebellion, and then unified the British and Irish parliaments through Acts of Union, which created the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Ireland. There are historians who believe George acted to establish the monarchical authority over Parliament that existed before the Glorious Revolution of 1688, which deposed King James II, who tried to build a centralized autocratic state. But George's actions suggest instead, most likely, that he was backing his governments instead of dictating to them. He did want to restore the monarch's power to choose his ministers, but once chosen, they had the freedom to govern as they saw fit. Further attacks came to George in 1804 and 1806, but the general impression of these episodes was that they were only temporary. Parliament accepted these explanations and didn't suspend any more royal functions. Physicians didn't examine him, and the public had no idea of the progression of George's madness. It's understandable that they ignored warning signs, as George exercised his prerogatives during these periods. On March 9, 1804, George received 15 bills and signed them all. He was keeping busy. Well, let's get back to the source of George's madness, which has been heavily debated for centuries. Researchers have tried to find the source of it since the end of his reign. He's been diagnosed with mania, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, and countless other forms of mental illness, whether biological or psychological in origin. In George's lifetime, doctors did their best to determine his madness. Dr. Willis testified to a parliamentary committee in December 1810 whether George was mad or delirious. The doctor thought George suffered from delirium, which he said was less harmful than insanity. He said, "I consider the king's derangement more nearly allied to delirium. In delirium, the mind is actively employed upon past impressions, which rapidly pass in succession. In insanity, there may be little or no disturbance, apparently, in the general constitution. The mind is occupied upon some fixed assumed idea, and the individual is acting always upon that false impression. Also, the mind is awake to objects which are present. His Majesty's illness uniformly partakes more of the delirium than of insanity." This was one interpretation, but theories of George's madness were scattershot and all over the map until the 20th century. At this point, most researchers named the culprit porphyria, a blood disease. In 1966, doctors Ida McAlpine and her son Richard Hunter published the landmark paper, The Insanity of King George III, a classic case of porphyria. They claimed that George suffered from acute porphyria, an inherited blood disorder that caused hallucinations, paranoia, confusion, insomnia, and restlessness. The diagnosis, they wrote, was plausible because George's cousins also suffered this disease. His extended family were royals across Europe, a testimony to the inbreeding of the continent's aristocratic class. The porphyria diagnosis, as a result, spread and entered popular consciousness. This diagnosis of porphyria was accepted at the time in the 20th century, and not only was it accepted in academic circles, but it soon entered the popular consciousness. This was the basis of Alan Bennett's long-running play, The Madness of King George. McAlpine and Hunter described five attacks of the illness, beginning in 1765, and they occurred until George's death. Although they claimed with specificity that George suffered from intermittent acute porphyria, the researchers couldn't find anyone among George's descendants who suffered from this illness. Their study concluded that George's condition wasn't a mental one, in whatever archaic or modern terms used to describe it. It may have been the first description of a rare metabolic disorder never completely understood. The two published the work Porphyria in the Royal Houses of Stuart, Hanover, and Prussia in 1967, claiming that George alone didn't suffer porphyria. He was joined by many other European royals, all of whose conditions originated from Mary, Queen of Scots, 200 years earlier. The British Medical Journal thought the research was so important that it published a supplement in the same journal issue, backed in royal purple, entitled Porphyria, a Royal Malady. McAlpine and Hunter claimed that James VI of Scotland, who became James I of England, also had porphyria. He had repeated bouts of abdominal colic and nausea, vomiting and diarrhea, an irregular pulse, and spasms in his limb. Once an attack had begun, uncontrollable weeping also occurred. Jeffrey Dean, a physician who practiced medicine for 60 years, challenged the porphyria thesis in a series of articles in the British Medical Journal and in Scientific American. "The British royal family was unafflicted with porphyria," he wrote, "because in acute porphyria, the urine is a normal color when passed, but darkens when left standing. Medical accounts claim George III's urine was dark when passed. Additionally, the condition was unlikely to have passed directly down the royal family from Mary, Queen of Scots, to George IV through nine generations." Professor Martin Warren put forward an alternate theory in 2003 that the same medicine which George's physicians prescribed to cure his insanity may have accelerated it. A British museum worker discovered an envelope in a vault that held a lock of King George's hair. It was subjected to analysis, and it was found that the hair had over 300 times the toxic level of arsenic. The source of the toxin could have come from any number of products used in the time, such as skin cream or wig powder. But no amount of those substances had that level of arsenic, even before people understood its poisonous properties. The answer to this mystery came from the Royal Pharmaceutical Society. George's physicians gave him a medicine, as they called it, that was referred to as antimony, and it had dangerous levels of arsenic. Physicians had the good intentions of prescribing him cures to sustain his condition, but they may have unwillingly poisoned him. George consumed a 120-milligram dose of antimony and arsenic every 6 hours for the rest of his life. Likely, the poisons triggered porphyria attacks. So his doctors are trying to help him, but they may have only accelerated his fall into complete mental instability. More recent studies also disputed the porphyria diagnosis. In 2010, History of Psychiatry published an article arguing against porphyria as the cause of George's symptoms. The authors claimed that earlier research dismissed or downplayed medical evidence of the King's condition that didn't align with this theory. McAlpine and Hunter were highly selective in their interpretation and reporting of George's signs and symptoms. Therefore, more recent researchers believe the porphyria diagnosis can't be sustained. There also wasn't much evidence of George's discolored urine. Even machine learning algorithms have suggested new theories of the King's madness. A 2017 study analyzed 60 years of George's letters to detect signs of his failing mental health. Researchers used machine learning to read letters produced throughout his reign and noticed patterns and changes over time. The researchers taught the computer to identify 29 written features to distinguish between the mentally healthy and those who suffer from disorders. Writing features included the complexity of the sentences, the richness of vocabulary, and the variety of words. To establish a clear basis of comparison between George's well and mentally ill periods, this criterion was matched against letters written during the King's infamous 1788-1789 period of mental derangement, with texts that were written during periods of mental health. They selected letters based on political importance. George did write regularly to members of his family, but researchers only selected letters addressed to leading politicians of the time. The majority of these had requests to his ministers about political issues to make the dataset homogeneous. The results point toward him suffering from acute mania, which is a hyperactive condition that resembles the manic phase of bipolar disorder. Peter Garand, professor of neurology at St. George's University of London and co-author of the study, said the King's usage of English made clear the periods in which he suffered mental illness. King George wrote very differently when unwell compared to when he was healthy. In the manic periods, we could see that he used less rich vocabulary and fewer adverbs. He repeated words less often, and there was a lower degree of redundancy or wordiness, he wrote. While King George led the British Empire during a period of significant challenges, both foreign and domestic, the King's language didn't change in wartime and peacetime, suggesting the differences were due to mental illness, not work-related stress. Well, George ruled at a time of significant upheaval and social reform for Great Britain. Catholics couldn't vote or hold political office, a contested policy which the fiercely devout Anglican king upheld. The Industrial Revolution was in full force, and mechanization caused drastic changes to traditional employment, and many feared that they'd be put out of a job forever. In the 1760s, the radical journalist and parliamentarian John Wilkes severely criticized George and the press for a speech that endorsed the Paris Peace Treaty of 1763. He spread libelous rumors about the king's mother having relations with Prime Minister John Stuart, which led to his arrest. All the while, tensions between Catholics and Protestants simmered in the background, but they finally boiled over at the same time as the American Revolution. The year 1780 saw the worst riots in London's history, as over 1,000 died in the anti-Catholic Gordon riots, in which Protestants rioted and looted in response to what they thought was the threat of Catholic incursion in a British civil society. Attempted assassinations of George occurred with increasing frequency. Certain aggressors were mentally ill, such as a knife assailant in 1786 who didn't injure the king. Others were zealots, such as the millenarian James Hadfield, who believed in the imminent second coming of Christ and thought it could be advanced by attempting to kill the king. In 1800, he fired at the king as he entered the box at the Theatre Royal. George remained calm. He told the queen and the princesses to keep back. When they saw he wasn't hurt, the audience cheered the royal and broke into God Save the King. By 1810, George was still on the throne, but no longer made decisions. The king suffered progressive blindness from cataracts and required a secretary to record his correspondence. He teetered between wellness and madness, but external events threatened his fragile sanity. The king had recently lost his youngest daughter, Princess Amelia, and had long crying spells and melancholy. The Regency era began when future George IV ruled in his place. George III spent longer periods in spells of madness until he could no longer recover from them and was confined to Windsor Castle. Hope for the king's recovery persisted to the very end of his reign. At the end of May 1811, rumors went forth that he was better. On the night of May 20th, excitement swept over the royal borough of Windsor after an official report that royal physicians would allow the king to appear in public. The next day, his saddled horse was ready. A Windsor inhabitant recalls the scene. "We crowded to the park and the castle yard. The favorite horse was there. The venerable man, blind but steady, was soon in the saddle, as I have often seen him, a hobby groom at his side with the leading rein. He rode through the little park to the great park. The bells rang. The troops fired a feu de joie. The king returned to castle within the hour." Sadly, George was never seen again outside those walls. George's health entered into terminal decline. The final 8 years of his life were, except for rare intervals, passed in mental and visual darkness. He occupied a large and convenient suite of apartments on the ground floor fronting the North Terrace within the walls at Windsor Castle. But until the very end, he never forgot that he was king, even in the depths of his madness. Attacks continued in fits and spurts. He had a neurological breakdown and often couldn't move on his own. George eventually lost his sight and hearing and began suffering regular seizures. He had in-depth discussions with phantom courts and reviewed troop movements when no one was around. He even spoke with his deceased daughter about her funeral. By 1814, the king was unaware he had been named King of Hanover. In his final years, those close to George allowed few visitors in order to prevent reports of his condition, conversation, or habits. He couldn't understand the news that his wife died in 1818. In the last year of his life, he had a streak of speaking nonsense that lasted close to 60 hours. George died on January 29, 1820, at the age of 81. The tolling bell of St. Paul's Cathedral rang soon after, announcing it to London. The king had reigned more than 60 years. His reign was, at the time, longer than any English sovereign, and it was only surpassed by his granddaughter Victoria by 4 days. Unlike Caligula and French King Charles, George's madness had positive effects on his nation and, some would argue, world civilization. The king was a lover and patron of the arts because of, not in spite of, his battles with mental health. For example, he found comfort in music while suffering the effects of his illness. McAlpine, who was writing about George's recovery in 1788, writes that George amused himself by walking, reading Shakespeare and Pope, practicing on his flute, brushing up his Latin, arranging his gardens and hothouses, and entertaining the queen and the princesses. While the king was weak and dysfunctional during his final years, during times of tranquility and contentment, he played the flute or harpsichord, particularly his favorite, Handel. The Duke of York, who cared for George after the queen's death in 1818, reported that after visiting the king in 1819, he was amusing himself with playing upon the harpsichord and singing with as strong and firm a voice as he ever heard him. And because of his love of the arts, he also patronized them a lot too. So this was part of the reason that Baroque music was so successful in England. Biographers who were less sympathetic to George believed the king, even before he descended into madness, was feeble-minded and danger of mental collapse. He depended on others for advice, such as the Earl of Bute and his successors. J.H. Plum wrote that the tragedy of George III lay in his temperament. His stupidity and obstinacy might have been forgiven if only they had been exercised on the trivialities of politics. But ever since McAlpine argued that George was not mentally ill, but suffered from porphyria, revisionist historians have re-examined the king's character. Stanley Eiling, a historian of George, Edmund Burke, John Wesley, and other prominent 18th-century figures in Great Britain, wrote in his 1972 biography that George, while not an intellectual, also wasn't dull. He called George a Royal John Bull, who was loved and respected by the English people. His hobbies and interests were those of a man with intellectual taste. In 1762, the king paid £20,000 for the art collection of Joseph Smith, English consul in Venice, to decorate Buckingham Palace. Among the works were Johannes Vermeer's Baroque masterpiece, Lady at the Virginals with a Gentleman. George was also a voracious reader and bibliophile. He made literary references even at the onset of his mental illness. In 1788, he asked for King Lear to read, and noted, "I am like poor Lear, but thank God I have no Regan, no Goneril, only 3 Cordelias, referring to Shakespeare's trio of fictional daughters, the latter being loyal to her father. His library at the time of his death had 65,000 books and 450 manuscripts. George gave serious researchers access to his works, which became the nucleus of the British National Library. John Adams described the library as such. The books were in perfect order, elegant in their editions, paper binding, but gaudy and extravagant in nothing. They were chosen with perfect taste and judgment, every book that a king ought to have always at hand, and as far as I could examine and could be supposed of judging, none other. For 150 years, George III was believed to be a demented and a bumbling imbecile. But later diagnoses and new examinations of his artistic interest and support for the arts paint a different picture. He was a courageous but despondent figure who loved his wife, high culture, family, subjects, and humanity in general. So I would argue that George wasn't a tyrant or a feeble-minded weakling. He was somebody who fought a brave but losing battle against his own sanity. All right, well, that's all for this episode. In the next episode, we're going to be looking at King Ludwig of Bavaria. See you then. There you have it. That is all for today's episode. Once again, I want to start things off by thanking the Spymasters of History Unplugged. I'll explain what that is in a second. Our Spymasters include Bill Ivey, Moondoggy from Ohio, Tom from Ohio, Ryan Gillen, Rob from Chicago, Nick Brooks, Michael from New York, Carl from Norway, Josh Reddick, Jennifer French Lee, Jay Carrington, McCrays, David Santee, Chris C., and Baron Fraser. If you'd like to support the show, there's some very easy ways to do so. First, go to the site halfpricehistory.com. I've worked out an arrangement with a lot of the authors who've appeared on this show, and you can go there and get their books for 50% off. All you have to do is go to halfpricehistory.com and enter the promo code UNPLUGGED at checkout. Second, please leave a review and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast player of choice, whether Apple Podcasts or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever. Third, join our Facebook group. You can go to Facebook and search for History Unplugged. There, you can talk with other fans of the show about recent episodes, what you liked, what you didn't like. Also, I have exclusive content there, such as live streams, where I do live versions of podcast episodes, where you can leave feedback as I'm talking, and I will address it on air. Last, and I think this is the best, is to join our membership program, the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were George Washington's spies during the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the membership program for History Unplugged. If you go to patreon.com/unplugged, you can join the membership program at three levels. If you join at the Scout level, you'll get all 400 episodes of History Unplugged absolutely ad-free and early access to new episodes. If you join at the second level, the Intelligence Officer level, get all the stuff that Scouts get, along with bonus episodes. There's currently about 40 of them, including series on Audie Murphy and Operation Long Jump about the Nazi attempt to assassinate FDR, Churchill, and Stalin in 1943. Finally, if you join at the Spymaster level, you'll get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode. You get a three-pack of hardcover history books, and you can find out what those are if you go to patreon.com/unplugged. Finally, you can ask me a question about history on absolutely any topic on earth, and I will research it and devote an entire episode to your question. Probably about 30% of the questions in the archive for the show have been based on these sorts of questions. So there you go. Go to patreon.com/unplugged to learn more. All right, well, that is all for today's episode. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.